Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Wednesday, July 16th, 2025. And today our business headlines begin with stock market today, Dow gains after earnings, soft inflation data. Johnny Walker owner, Diego, replaces CEO as challenges mount. Oil futures lower ahead of U.S. inventory data. Dollar falls but bounces back after soft inflation index. Ford Motor recalls some Broncos over fuel injectors. Treasury yields fall on soft U.S. wholesale inflation. Recession time for the GOP Senate. Mamadani clarifies globalize the intifada stance in meeting with business elites. PCAOB Chair Erica Williams to resign at request of SEC Chairman. Our first article today is Estée Lauder, a late digital adopter, makes new push to reach shoppers online. CEO Stephanie De La Favre hires a Nestle executive to help lead the beauty giant's digital revamp by Natasha Khan. Late to embrace online retail, Estée Lauder is launching a digital push under its new chief executive officer to reverse a years-long sales slump. When Stephanie De La Favre took the helm in January, he announced a revamp that involved meeting customers where they are, which is increasingly online. The company's share price has plunged in the past few years, hurt in part by a pullback in spending by Chinese consumers. The beauty giant, concerned about its brand's high-end cachet, has also shown to sell products at retailers like Sephora and Amazon.com. Now its CEO has a different outlook. The future of the beauty industries will exist as a merger of the digital and the physical world, De La Favre said in an interview. And artificial intelligence is changing the way people shop for cosmetics, he said. Estée Lauder has hired a senior executive from Nestle to help drive a digital overhaul. Ade Gandon will become Estée Lauder's first chief digital and marketing officer, helping the maker of Tom Ford fragrances and La Mer face cream compete for customers in the industry that is becoming more competitive, digital, and driven by AI. Gandon's remit includes both online commerce and store design, De La Favre said. I don't see where we sell the either within four walls or a digital platform, De La Favre said. The reality is consumers may discover a brand or product on social media or in a store. There are so many entry points. AI will change the way many consumers mix and match, De La Favre said. If customers like a red lipstick, they could use AI to suggest and discover complementary products. The company is also mining consumer data and online buzz to identify trends more quickly and create products that capitalize on them. Gandon, as Nestle's global chief marketing officer, led the company's digital transformation across 188 markets and more than 2,000 brands, while developing partnership with such companies as Amazon and Netflix. Estée Lauder's turnaround plan, called Beauty Reimagined, aims to restore sales growth and boost margins over the next few years. The company said it increased its U.S. market share of high-end cosmetics in the quarter ended March 31st. But overall, Estée Lauder reported a drop in North American net sales, attributing the decline in part to sinking consumer confidence. The company's CEO said he wants to retain existing customers while attracting new ones, particularly young people. Younger consumers are the ones that are driving the trends today, said De La Favre. They're the ones that are influencing the older generations. Write to Natasha Khan at natasha.khan@wsj.com. Our next article is Mamadani clarifies globalize the intifada stance in meeting with business elites. New York City mayoral frontrunner says he will discourage use of slogan. By Kevin T. Dugan, Ben Glickman, and Peter Rudgier. Zoran Mamadani said he would discourage the use of the slogan globalize the intifada in a roughly hour-long meeting with some New York City's most powerful executives on Tuesday, seeking to defuse an issue that has prompted a backlash from the business community and beyond. Mamadani, the Democratic nominee for New York City mayor, was questioned by a room of more than 100 executives at an event hosted by the Partnership for New York City, an influential business group. The audience included finance and real estate executives, high-powered lawyers, and a handful of billionaires. Many in attendance said they walked away impressed by the 33-year-old candidate's ability to work a crowd, but no more comfortable with his ideas. It could have been a lot worse, one attendee said. Pfizer chief executive Albert Bourla and Rob Speyer, CEO of the real estate firm Tishman Speyer, moderated the event, which also included questions from the audience. Bourla, the son of Holocaust survivors, confronted Mamadani about the phrase globalize the intifada, which some see as a call for violence against Jews. In a response that lasted several minutes, Mamadani said that for him the phrase means protest against the Israeli occupation of Gaza. He said he is willing to discourage the specific language, but not the idea behind it. Centerview Partners co-founder Blair Efron questioned Mamadani about how he would go about managing a city as big as New York. James Tisch, the CEO of Lowe's, asked a question about preventing repeat shoplifting offenders. Jeff Blau, the CEO of Related Costs, asked him about his beliefs on seizing private property. Mamadani, at one point, said he has posted a lot on social media over the years and that viewpoints can change or be taken out of context. He asked the audience not to hold every old tweet against him. Asked whether he would defund the police, Mamadani focused on his proposal to increase community mental health services. Others in attendance include Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi and Vox Media President Pam Wasserstein. Mamadani's two biggest competitors, Mayor Eric Adams and former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, have been racing to shore up support from the same business crowd. Last week, Adams hopped around Manhattan to raise funds from the real estate industry. On Monday, Cuomo said he wasn't leaving the race and would run as an independent. With a field that executives worry is unlikely to narrow, some are now focused on influencing whom Mamadani might include in a potential administration. Many have applauded New York City Police Commissioner Jessica Tisch, the daughter of James Tisch, for a drop in crime under her watch. Mamadani has said he was open to keeping Tisch in her current position. Asked about her on Wednesday's meeting, he said he hasn't made personnel announcements yet. Mamadani has campaigned on promises to freeze rent in rent-stabilized buildings, offer free bus rides, and open government-run grocery stores, part of a pitch to make the city more affordable. He stepped up his outreach to the business crowd since his decisive primary win last month and recently started cold-calling finance executives. Many of the top executives, including J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon and BlackRock's Larry Fink, sat out Tuesday's meeting, though some said they are giving priority to one-on-one meetings. The event came hours after Mamadani held a private breakfast meeting in Washington, D.C., with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a fellow Democrat socialist and a longtime foe of Wall Street. On the way to the event, Mamadani, who arrived in a black SUV and wore a black suit, said he planned on being consistent and being open to the audience. Afterwards, he said he enjoyed the discussion. We look forward to the opportunity to build on this conversation, even in navigating disagreement on fiscal policy, a spokesperson for the campaign said. The Partnership for New York City counts the city's most powerful banks, law firms, and corporations as members. The group is holding a second meeting with Mamadani on Wednesday that will cater to executives in the technology sector. It's hosting a breakfast with Adams on Thursday morning. Write to Kevin T. Dugan at kevin.dugan@wsj.com, Glenn Glickman at ben.glickman@wsj.com, and Peter Rudgier at peter.rudegeier@wsj.com. PCAOB Chair Erica Williams to resign at request of SEC Chairman. Williams' last day will be July 22nd, according to an email she sent to staff, by Walden Sue and Mark Maurer. Public Companies Accounting Oversight Board Chair Erica Williams is stepping down after Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Paul Atkins asked her to resign. Her last day will be July 22nd, according to an email she sent to PCAOB staff. Today I accept Erica Williams' offer to resign as chair and board member of the PCAOB and thanked her for her service, Atkins said. We look forward to advancing our oversight responsibilities of the PCAOB as it continues its important work. PCAOB leadership was revamped by the past two presidential administrations, and the watchdog has been bracing for another shakeup in President Trump's second term, even its potential elimination. The Republican-led House in May paused a provision to eliminate the PCAOB and fold it into the SEC as part of a tax and spending megabill. However, it was spared earlier this month as the Senate passed a bill that no longer included the provision. Williams, a former litigation partner at the law firm Kirkland & Ellis, started as chair of the auditing watchdog in January of 2022 and was reappointed in June of 2024. The PCAOB under Williams led a push during the Biden administration to set several auditing standards that auditors opposed. A proposed rule on fraud and detection was particularly contentious, with auditors saying it would require skills that go far beyond their professional abilities, while many investigators saying it would help provide transparency. The PCAOB, shortly after Trump's election, scrapped plans to vote in 2024 on adopting it, leaving its fate uncertain. I know you have questions about what is next for PCAOB leadership. Unfortunately, I do not have the answers you deserve, Williams said in her email to staff. The PCAOB plays an essential role in protecting the investments and retirement savings of workers and families across the country, while helping to ensure our capital markets remain the envy of the world, she said. With high economic uncertainty increasing the risk of fraud, the PCAOB's mission is as important as ever. The SEC appoints the PCAOB's board members, including the chair, and can remove them at will. Atkins frequently criticized the auditing watchdog as a Republican SEC commissioner in the 2000s. The SEC under Gary Gensler in 2021 dismissed Trump-era PCAOB chair William Dunkey and replaced most of the five-member board amid what was described in an SEC commission report as a culture of fear under Dunkey. 4 years earlier, during Trump's first term, the SEC, then led by Jay Clayton, replaced the entire board. Write to Walden Sue at waldensiew@wsj.com. Aquarian nears deal for U.S. insurer Brighthouse. A number of private equity firms had expressed interest in the insurer, by Miriam Gottfried, and Lauren Thomas. Investment firm Aquarian Holdings is in exclusive talks to acquire the U.S. life insurance company Brighthouse Financial, according to people familiar with the matter. A deal could be completed in the coming weeks, the people said, granting the talks don't hit any last-minute hurdles. It would mark the end of a competitive process for Brighthouse, which has drawn interest from a number of other big private equity firms. TPG, the other finalist in the process, had been angling for a structured deal involving only certain parts of the company, instead of a full purchase, according to a person familiar with the matter. It wasn't able to reach an agreement and didn't submit a final bid, the person said. Brighthouse, which has spun out of MetLife in 2017, is one of the biggest providers of annuities and life insurance in the U.S. Brighthouse has a market value of about $2.8 billion. Its shares have whipsawed this year on speculation of a possible deal. Founded in 2017 by Guggenheim Partners alumnus Rudy Sehe, Aquarian manages $22.8 billion in assets, according to its website. Last year, it raised $1.5 billion from Abu Dhabi state-owned investment company Mubadala to expand into areas such as private credit and insurance. Aquarian already owns a number of insurance assets. In March, the firm announced the formation of Aquarian Insurance Holdings to house its reinsurance and retail insurance business. Write to Miriam Gottfried at miriam.gottfried@wsj.com and Lauren Thomas at lauren.thomas@wsj.com. Goodles thinks mac and cheese shouldn't be adults' secret meal anymore. A fledgling brand is winning share by spicing up a product ordinarily pitched to kids, by Megan Graham. A new brand of macaroni and cheese is winning market share and taking over shelves with its colorful boxes, cheeky meat names, and focus on young adults who previously may have seen packaged powder and noodles as a meat choice to hide. Goodles markets its products as Goodles Gooder by virtue of being nutrition dense and containing more protein and fiber than competitors. Since its introduction online in 2021, the brand has inspired countless TikTok videos ranking grown-up flavors like Smoky Doki and Here Comes Truffle. Added distribution at big retailers including Target and Whole Foods, and opened a sign-up list for its new microwavable cups after its website sold out of the first run in one night. I've never in my life seen a wait list for mac and cheese until now, one Instagram user commented on the product announcement. It's the kind of overnight ubiquity that has only recently seemed possible in the crowded business of consumer packaged goods as consumers became less loyal to incumbent brands. What we were seeing during this time period is new brands popping up seemingly out of nowhere and taking share from big incumbents, which would have been unthinkable even 15 years ago, said Goodles co-founder Paul Early, an adjunct lecturer at Northwestern University's Kellogg Business School, citing examples like Ollie Vitamins. There are a lot of things that these upstarts had in common. Beautiful design in an ugly space, appeal to younger consumers, improved products, new energy, new language, breaking convention. Early and fellow co-founder Jen Zezut, the former chief executive at baby food marketer Cerebelli and a former intern at packaged goods giant Procter & Gamble, decided they could freshen up mac and cheese with a new brand that would eschew the bunny tails and cartoon character crossovers of the big players' packaging. Kraft and Annie's are duking it out over moms that are feeding it to their little kids, said Zezut, chief executive at Goodles. We can get the families with kids, but we might be able to massively grow this category and not duke it out with them. The brand's website, to that end, says its Chetty Mac flavor tastes like your childhood, but eats like a balanced meal. Shella Good promises silky delicious mouthfeel. Zezet said Goodle's research has shown many young adults are eating mac and cheese in secret, seeing it as something embarrassing they should have left behind in childhood. This feels like a huge unlock in terms of growing the category, she said. Goodle's has raised nearly $28 million to chase that opportunity from firms such as Caterton and celebrity backers, including Gal Gadot, a founding partner in the company, and Christiana Aguilera. Cheese and mac and cheese is a big business, each year generating an estimated $1.8 billion to $2 billion in sales of shelf-stable products in the U.S., according to Consumer Edge, a firm that analyzes purchase data from credit and debt transactions, receipts, and point-of-sale systems. But category leader Kraft Mac and Cheese has been under pressure for about 2 years, losing ground to Goodle's because of the newcomer's health-forward appeal, said Michael Gunther, vice president and head of insights at Consumer Edge. Goodle's won 4% of U.S. spending on shelf-stable macaroni and cheese last year, up from 0.6% in 2023, according to consumer data from Numerator. Kraft Heinz Kraft Mac and Cheese saw its market share in that same period decline to 38.3% from 42.9%, while sibling brand Velveeta slipped to 20.2% from 22.1%. Annie's was the only mainstream brand to grow to 10.4% from 9.4%. The figures, derived from an app where consumers share their shopping data, cover all channels and retailers except direct-to-consumer sales. Goodle's Maker Foods began turning profit in 2024, its founder said. Kraft Heinz, meanwhile, is planning to spin off a large chunk of its grocery business amid weakening demand for some of its core products, from macaroni and cheese to mayonnaise. Kraft last year introduced a flavor-focused expansion strategy for its namesake mac and cheese line as the growth of flavored products outpaced the total category, according to the company. New varieties have included jalapeno ranch, everything bagel, and smoky BBQ. Kraft has also tried to target adults with some campaigns, including through a promotion in 2020 with the theme @SendNudes. Goodle's has helped invigorate the category by tapping into adult desires for better ingredients, more protein, and nostalgia, said Nate Rosen, who writes about consumer packaged goods for his newsletter Express Checkout. When Goodle's came onto the scene, it felt fresh. It felt like upgraded nostalgia, which I think is something that has been working across CPG in general, Rosen said. The brand has also projected healthiness without hammering the point, making it accessible for consumers who might be wary of sacrificing taste or texture, said Melanie Bartlemy, an associate director of food and drink at research firm Mintel. The lines between natural foods and specialty fun foods and junk foods were much sharper when Goodle's adult shoppers were still children. Even before the pandemic, it was starting to really coverage up and be this place where you would have a product that was being advertised as clean label natural, but it also had super fun box colors and had really interesting flavors, Bartlemy said. There's so much more overlap right now. Early said Goodle's has benefited from staying weird. It has a cheese waterfall made of wood in its office, keeps up pen pal relationships with doting fans, and sells holographic roller skates on its website for $165. The company's marketing strategy so far has relied primarily on posts and social media, giving away samples in venues like college campuses and Airbnbs, and gifting influencers. It has dabbled in digital ads, but hasn't done television, print, radio, or out-of-home advertising. "We can't outspend competitors," Zezet said. Google's older rivals also have the capital and cachet to keep punching back. The competitors have one big advantage, which is obviously they've been around for a while, said Rosen, the Express checkout writer. They have the capital to invest in the air quotes innovation, and they have the distribution already set and the brand equity. But consumers go for new packaged food products because they prefer the branding, the brand story, or the taste, Rosen said. Just because a legacy brand pumps out a dupe of the new brand or competitor to the new brand doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to do well with their product, he said. Write to Megan Graham at megan.graham@wsj.com. The battle to keep consumers means smaller packs of cookies and chips. PepsiCo, Campbell's, and others are shrinking packages with lower price options to spur sales. By Jennifer Williams. Consumer goods companies are enlarging their range of products by making them smaller. Diminutive snack and drink sizes are hitting store shelves as brands try to keep stretched consumers buying with lower price options. PepsiCo now sells Lay's potato chips in a half a dozen different sized bags, costing from around 50 cents to roughly $5. Campbell's new markets teensy packages of Pepperidge Farm cookies and Goldfish crackers, and Mondelez International has six different Milka chocolate bar sizes with prices from $1 to $6. Food, beverage, and consumer product companies are hoping that a wider range of shrinking size options can boost overall sales volumes, which have been pressured in recent quarters. Smaller size offerings also tend to have higher profit margins. Consumers are going into small pack sizes to optimize their absolute budget, said Mondelez finance chief Luca Zamorella. The $3 to $4, as opposed to the $6 to $7, particularly in snacks, are becoming a clear center of gravity. Consumer goods companies have long tailored packaging for cookies, chips, and other items to a range of factors: on-the-go or lunch snacking, portion control, affordability. The last one, however, critical in emerging markets for years, has recently become more important in the U.S., according to Rob Holston, head of the Global and Americas Consumer Products Sector Group at EY. Though inflation has moderated in recent years, prices on certain foods have remained excruciatingly high. In response, Americans are trying anything from treasure hunt shopping to buying fewer items, shopping less often, and switching to private labels to cut their shopping bills. By offering different sizes of a snack with a range of prices to match, companies aim to bring in new customers and keep existing ones. It's really around looking at purchasing power to make sure consumers can get into the franchise. And once they get in there, as they get more money in their pocket, they can actually move to larger pack sizes, Holstein said. So you haven't lost them just because the original product was unattainable because of pricing. For Mondelez, sales have been pressured as consumers cut back on snacking, executives said in April. Overall revenue in the first quarter barely rose, edging up 0.2% to $9.31 billion, as strong sales in Europe and the Asia, Middle East, and Africa segment offset declines of 8.8% in Latin America and 4.1% in North America. The maker of Milka, Cadbury, and Toblerone chocolate, Mondelez has raised some price tags to offset cocoa prices that have roughly tripled over the last 2 years. Meanwhile, as stretched consumers prioritize essentials in store aisles, some are cutting back on snacks. but price variety is helping Mondelez hold on to these people. The company recently rolled out smaller sleeves of Ritz crackers and Oreo cookies, for instance, which retail for around $3. The snack giant's cookies and crackers category grew roughly 0.3% compared with a year earlier, largely because of the more affordable pack options, executives said in late April. If you're on a tight budget and you favor certain things versus others, particularly when those things cost a little bit more, obviously you tend to prioritize, Zamorella said. We need to be able to hold on to our consumers that have a limited amount of out-of-pocket spend. The CFO declined to disclose how much the company invests in packaging. Campbell's executives see a 2.5-ounce grab pack of Goldfish, which retails for less than $2, as a sweet spot for consumers. Liquor giant Diageo is selling smaller bottles of Don Julio tequila that executives say appeal to consumers looking to spend less on alcohol. And Lay's potato chip maker PepsiCo, which has for years offered numerous price points in emerging markets, started rolling out even more price tag varieties in the U.S. this spring. Even Costco Wholesale, known for its bulk offerings, is slimming down packages in certain categories to meet consumer preference. For instance, fresh muffins that used to come in two packs of six muffins each for $9.99 are now sold as a pack of eight for $6.99. Muffin sales have grown as a result, said Costco CFO Gary Millerchip. In general, I would say we're always looking for bigger items, he said. But there are examples, like the muffins, where we go a little smaller because that's the right size for the member to give the best value. Still, there are downsides to adding more package sizes. In some cases, consumers clearly see they're getting less, fewer potato chips, cookies, pretzels, for instance, but not a correspondingly lower price, a tactic known as shrinkflation that has chafed shoppers in recent years. It can also be expensive to add packaging sizes, but those costs can be minimal or even reduced if done right, said Ken Bowles, a group finance chief at Summerfit Westrock, which makes dishwasher pods packaging, soap containers, cereal boxes, and other forms of packaging for some of the largest consumer goods companies. With tweaks such as changing the packaging materials or re-engineering boxes so more fit on delivery trucks, companies can add sizes and cut spending, he said. Another difficulty is that just as some brands expand their product lineups, retailers are working to reduce the number of products on their shelves, intensifying the already stiff competition for shelf space. Companies want the single-serve option to attract consumers, but they also want the multi-pack and several options to drive volumes, said Bonnie Herzog, a senior analyst covering the beverage, tobacco, and convenience store sectors in global investment research at Goldman Sachs. But there's only so much space for some of these categories, she said, and it's harder to come by. Write to Jennifer Williams at jennifer.williams@wsja.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Shoppers are slowly turning away from plastic packaging. New survey finds more than a third of U.S. and Canadian respondents have decided against buying something because of unsustainable packaging. By Yusuf Khan. Shoppers in the U.S. and Canada are walking away from purchases in stores over worries about unsustainable packaging and concerns about plastics, according to a new survey. The research, conducted by sustainability consulting firm Oruf, found 37% of consumers surveyed across the two countries had decided against buying something because it was unsustainably packaged. The figure rose to 42% for European consumers. Packaging is the new pressure point for North American brands and retailers, said Gillian Garside White, director of consulting at Aura. It's become a visible test of their environmental credibility and if they're willing to accept the costs of positive change. Consumers are clearly making decisions based on whether businesses are serious about sustainability, she added. In particular, the survey found that 80% of all respondents said brands and retailers were using too much packaging, though only 57% of the North American respondents saw a direct link between packaging waste and climate change. That percentage was significantly higher in Europe, the survey said. The United Nations Environment Program estimated in 2021 that 400 million tons of plastic are produced annually. Concerns around chemicals and plastic in food packaging have been growing in recent years, but companies have been slow to address these worries. Last year, Coca-Cola pushed back its goals to cut the amount of plastic in its products and use more recycled plastic in packaging. Similarly, Unilever also postponed its timetable for using less virgin plastics in its products last year. The two companies are members of a larger group that includes General Mills, Kraft Heinz, and Eastman Chemical, among others, that in 2020 signed the U.S. Plastics Pact, aiming to cut down on plastic waste. Goals of the group had included phasing out plastic straws, cutlery, and PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, recycling or composting half of their plastic packaging, and making sure 100% of plastic packaging is reusable, recyclable, or compostable, all by 2025. Those goals have been pushed to 2030. When we launched in 2020, especially for the U.S. market, we didn't know what we didn't know, and because of that, the targets that were set on the 2025 timeline were extremely ambitious, said Emily Tipoledo, who was executive director of the U.S. Plastics Pact at the time she sized up its progress last summer. I don't know that there was frankly anyone out there who thought we were going to meet all of the things. It's more about lighting a fire under people. Meanwhile, worries over the harm from chemicals found in everyday items and foods continues to rise, an issue touted by U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. A recent study published in the scientific journal Nature assessed more than 16,000 chemicals used to make plastics and found over 4,200 of them were of concern in human health, being persistent, bioaccumulative, mobile, or toxic. The shift in consumer sentiment reflected in the Aura survey remains a risk for companies in food, personal care, and e-commerce, said Warside White. This data is a wake-up call, she said, adding that government policies that put the onus on companies for the cost of recovering and recycling their packaging will call for more accurate data on it in places like the UK and Europe. Without it, they risk losing customers and facing financial penalties, a double hit to the bottom line. Write to Yusuf Khan at yusuf.khan@wsj.com. Post-crisis rules to keep banks safe are on the way out. On both sides of the Atlantic, there's a new willingness to rethink tough banking regulations, by Joe Wallace. London, at a banquet in a gilded palace here on Tuesday night, UK Treasury Chief Rachel Reeves will outline plans to kick the country's huge financial industry into a higher gear. The planned address reflects a new willingness in both the US and the UK to rethink tough banking regulations, rules put in place to stop the kind of financial crisis that enveloped the world nearly two decades ago. There is transatlantic momentum, said Stephen Kelly, Associate Research Director at the Yale Program on Financial Stability. Reeves will offer several concessions to the industry at the dinner in Mansion House, the Lord Mayor of London's centuries-old residence. She plans to say the government will loosen rules holding the finance executives accountable for their company's conduct, a Treasury official said, and will simplify a system for resolving consumer complaints about financial companies. She even plans to acknowledge banks' concerns about the ring fence, a signature British defense against banking meltdowns, people familiar with the matter said. Though she won't commit to wholesale changes, the industry has stepped up calls to water down the measure, which requires big lenders to separate retail banking operations into different entities. The Treasury official said London would take a balanced approach and is committed to appropriate financial stability. The finance-heavy UK was walloped in the financial crisis, and its regulatory response was correspondingly tougher than most other jurisdictions. While the ring-fence rollback is mostly being pushed by big British banks, J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs also support the effort, said people familiar with the matter. Both banks use London as international hubs and have growing retail operations here. Executives from the U.S. institutions have repeatedly told British officials the ring fence is one of the main constraints on how far these digital retail offerings can grow. Internationally, the tone on banking regulation has changed recently, industry insiders and regulators say. Memories have faded from the crisis, when thinly capitalized banks, stuffed with toxic mortgages, fell prey to a confidence crisis that sank the global economy. Governments, eager to spur growth, also see reduced regulation as a way to juice the economy. Lobbyists have already scored wins. Last year, Wall Street Journal torpedoed a planned increase to capital requirements, running a campaign that included airport posters and roadside billboards. And Wall Street executives notched a victory last month when U.S. regulators proposed changes to ease borrowing limits imposed after the financial crisis via a measure known as the Supplementary Leverage Ratio. In London, after being told by lawmakers to facilitate the UK's international competitiveness, the Bank of England removed a cap on banker bonuses. There are exceptions. Switzerland, hammered by the collapse of Credit Suisse in 2023, has proposed tighter requirements for UBS, its remaining behemoth bank. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank has also increased the scrutiny of U.S. regulation over mid-sized lenders. The cornerstone of the British effort after the crisis was the ring fence. It forced big banks to cordon ordinary deposit taking and payment services off from trading and deal making. Banks shuffled around more than $1 trillion in assets and spent almost $4 billion restructuring before the policy took effect in 2019. The ring-fence officials hoped would discourage UK lenders from taking on too much risk by making clear that the government would let their investment banking units fail in a crisis. Their ring-fence units have channeled resources instead to domestic mortgage lending. UK banks spied an opportunity this spring after the Labour government echoed some of President Trump's rhetoric on regulation. UK ministers sanded some edges off the ring fence this February before the current effort by banks to scrap it outright. When HSBC's new chief executive, Georges Elderly, joined with the bosses of NatWest, Lloyds Banking, and Santander's UK retail arm to write to Reeves, the Treasury chief, they argued that they could better support growth without the ring fence, which they said distorts lending decisions and makes it difficult to provide customers with the products they need. Giving some in London a sense of whiplash, NatWest CEO Paul Thwaite signed the letter weeks before his bank decisively emerged from the state ownership. Formerly known as the Royal Bank of Scotland, The lender was the poster child for excess when it swelled to be the world's biggest bank before failing, requiring a bailout that led to 17 years of state backing. Thwaite told lockmakers the ring fence had been superseded by rules that require banks to be structured in a way for them to fail without spreading damage. His bank would benefit the most, according to RBC Capital Markets analyst Benjamin Toms, gaining about half a billion pounds, the equivalent of roughly $675 million in annual pre-tax profit, by channeling deposits into its operations outside the ring fence. The sector as a whole would earn an extra 1.5 billion euros, he calculates. John Vickers, who led the commission that proposed the ring fence in 2011, doubts the economy would reap the benefits of its removal. Instead, he said, banks would just use domestic deposits to do more international investment banking business, exposing the economy and public finance to greater risks. But the government wants more, not less, investment in the UK, said Vickers. The BOE, which policies the fence, is open to examining the issue, but is likely to resist sweeping changes, said some of the people familiar with the matter. Governor Andrew Bailey wrote to lawmakers saying the UK needed to shield the deposits of households and small businesses if it chooses to be home to an open international banking center. And Barclays, one of UK lender with a chunky investment bank, didn't sign the letter. Remember, it wasn't long ago that the UK put in about 130 billion euros to prop up some British and Icelandic banks, CEO C.S. Vandakrishnan said in April. Write to Joe Wallace at joe.wallace@wsj.com. Inside one company's prolonged tariff limbo. Outdoor product maker American Outdoor Brands has plans for moving production out of China. Executives just need clarity. By Jennifer Williams. American Outdoor Brands spent months coming up with a plan to minimize the pain of tariffs. Now it's stuck waiting to see where to go. Most American Outdoor Brands products, which range from fishing tools to hunting gear and pizza ovens, come from China. Executives were prepared to reposition the company's supply chain ahead of July 9th, when the so-called reciprocal tariffs were set to take effect, betting that it would move quickly to reduce any pain points once the new levies kicked in. But President Trump's decision last week to extend the deadline for trade deal negotiations to August 1st has prolonged the uncertainty for many companies. That means American Outdoor Brands' supply chain reshuffling plan remains on ice. We're very comfortable that we've done all the upfront work on where we'd go by product category, said the company's chief financial officer, Andy Fulmer. We're just kind of waiting for those firm rates to come out. Trump had previously paused his April Liberation Day tariffs for dozens of countries for 90 days. The levies were set to take effect on July 9th, following the pause. Like American Outdoor Brands executives, corporate leaders across industries were watching the July deadline closely. Diagnostic instruments and software company Aglent Technologies estimates an additional $40 million in gross exposure for the second half of the year if certain tariffs were to go into effect this month. Flooring retailer Floor & Decor Holdings expedited purchase orders for products in a bid to ensure their arrival before the end of the pause, executives said in May. Outdoor apparel and equipment retailer Columbia Sportswear similarly worked to fast-track inventory ahead of the deadline. We've been very focused on July 9th, Columbia Sportswear Chief Executive Tim Boyle said in May, but we have no idea what July 10th is going to be, or July 11th for that matter, so it's very difficult to be projecting large global business results. At American Outdoor Brands, which sells everything from backyard grills to camping equipment and meat grinders, at retailers including Academy Sports and Outdoors, Walmart, and Amazon.com, Momentum has been building in recent quarters. Net sales in the 3 months ended in April 30th at $61.9 million were up nearly 34% compared to the same period last year. The company tends to see higher sales between August and January, in part because of demand during peak hunting season and the holidays. Sales in the 3 months ended in April hit a 12-quarter high, a significant increase compared with the recent trend of declining sales in this period. Still, the company pulled net sales guidance for its 2026 year, in part because of tariff-related uncertainties. Executives for months have been actively exploring alternative production locations for their goods, most of which are currently made in China. The company in 2020 said around 80% of the products come from China. The last time an exact figure was disclosed. But it continues to be where most of the company's wares are made, Fulmer said. That may change. The company has reviewed its lineup of products from 20 brands to determine which could be relocated without affecting quality, while also reducing overall production costs based on where executives expect tariff rates could land. Suppliers in countries such as Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia, and Thailand are ready to start making the company's wares, connections that are being nurtured while the tariff hiatus continues. The Liberation Day tariffs proved that making a decision before the rates are settled could be a mistake, Fulmer said. When you saw Vietnam come out at 46%, we were like, oh my gosh, that would have been such a mistake to move things over, he said. We don't want to make a decision now that we're going to regret in 6 months, or whenever it happens, when things are completely solidified. Fulmer added, once we have that clarity, we're comfortable that within 6 to 12 months of making the decision to move, we'll be up and running. Negotiating with suppliers and price increases are also on the table to help offset tariff impacts. Already, prices are raised after 3 months ended in April, Fulmer said, declining to share specifics beyond that they are varied by product category. More price hikes may come, he said. But with the company regularly adding new products to its lineup, they have been targeted to account for about 20% and 25% of annual revenue in recent years. It's easier to negotiate with retailers about lifting price tags, said Matt Caranda, a senior research analyst at investment bank Roth Capital Partners. Another advantage for American outdoor brands is that company built up its inventories in anticipation of higher levies, which helps blunt the tariff impact, he said. Still, the continuing uncertainty has a ripple effect. The company will likely do some combination of moving manufacturing, raising prices, and working with suppliers to offset any higher costs because of the levies. Postponing decisions on where to make products makes sense given the unknowns, but it also likely delays firming up decisions on the other options, like pricing and vendor negotiations, he said. Just kicking the can for another week or two on tariffs, or a couple of months, it probably doesn't help consumer companies with planning for the year, he said. Write to Jennifer Williams at jennifer.williams@wsj.com. And here's an opinion article by the editorial board. Trump tariffs hit consumer prices. The June inflation bump probably takes a July Federal Reserve interest rate cut off the table. President Trump insists there is no inflation as he bludgeons the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates, but denying inflation reality won't make it go away. His tariffs are making it harder for a central bank to do what he wants, as last month's rise in the Consumer Price Index shows. The Labor Department's Consumer Price Report Tuesday showed inflation ticked up in June to 0.3% or 2.7% in the last year. Real average hourly earnings fell 0.1% as inflation eroded wage gains. Real average weekly earnings fell 0.4% and 0.6% for production-level workers as hours of work declined, perhaps because of slowing economy and labor market. Let's stipulate that tariffs don't cause inflation, which is an increase in the general price level. Inflation occurs when there is too much money chasing too few goods and is usually the result of monetary policy mistakes. But tariffs are taxes, and they do raise prices on the goods on which they're applied. Those prices increased may be a one-time event, depending on the tariff and how supply chains are affected. But Americans who experience these rising prices will still notice the decline in their purchasing power. And that's what they're seeing in the June inflation report. Price increases were broad-based, and especially in goods that are U.S. imports. Think toys, paper products, and appliances. The latter was the biggest increase since August of 2020. Food prices rose 0.3% despite a 7.4% decline in egg prices. One culprit was fresh fruit and vegetables, 1%, the biggest increase in more than a year. About 60% of fresh fruit and 35% of fresh vegetables were imported. Slapping tariffs on cherries from Chile and bananas from Guatemala won't cause more of them to be grown stateside, especially when farmers can't find workers. Prices for coffee, almost all of which is imported, rose 2.2%. Your cup of joe will get even more expensive if Mr. Trump follows through on his threat to impose a 50% tariff in Brazil. Carbonated drink prices notably rose 1.7%. Coca-Cola warned in February that it imports aluminum for cans from Canada, which would be subject to a 25% tariff, now 50%. While the company said it might shift to using more plastic bottles, the strategy has limits. The U.S. also imports large amounts of plastic. Imports make only 11% of U.S. consumer spending, but domestic producers will also take advantage of the tariff to raise prices. This is what happened after Mr. Trump slapped tariffs on washing machines in his first term. While imports fell by a third in the year after the tariffs took effect, prices rose 12% for washers and dryers. Trump advisors say the president's trade agenda is focused on helping Main Street, not Wall Street. But the irony is that the tariffs hurt Main Street, while the market volatility caused by his whip-swing tariff threats has been boon to Wall Street. J.P. Morgan's equity trading revenue hit a second-quarter record on Tuesday. The Trump team also overlooks that tariff effects will vary by industry and the ability of consumers and businesses to substitute for lower-cost alternatives. The fact that the June report doesn't show inflation in some tariff goods, like autos, doesn't seem mean that prices won't increase. Tariffs would have a long and variable lag to adapt Milton Friedman's famous line about monetary policy. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting articles on Sun Sounds.